It's a couple minutes after 9 o'clock at 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And we're for this next hour of programming. The opinions and views expressed are not necessarily those KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. Time now for Talking Animals on KUCI.
Wrong plug, slap the rotor to the beat, y'all sticks into the pin prick, got you down into the flat line, clap the matter is a drop, how revving it up into the stomp box, sucker fired ass man, tripping in his own dribble, triple in the white fans outlay, capital is up now, screening on the fat tomato, scream girl, it's up, thicker than a car, I know the bug, is why I'm running down into the pool, screaming girl, you're coming fast, my soul, I know the bug, is why I'm running down into the pool. Screaming, girl, you're coming fast, my soul. I know the bug is why I'm running down into the hole. Screaming, girl, you're coming fast, my soul. I know the bug is why I'm running down into the hole. Screaming, girl, you're coming fast, my soul. Shuffle back the pole sound, 1-2, 1-2, drumming on the gear shift. I can't stand it when a dream comes doubling up the whole brain stem. I cannot do up. You just stick there, liquid in the sink. My thought is useless, but you just
That's music from Soul Coffee with Bug as we slide into today's edition of Talking Animals. Yeah, peppy note, hopefully. It's on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Streaming live on the internet at KUCI.org. And the whole enterprise, the whole shebang, the whole nine yards, the whole enchilada, etc., is broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'll be with you till 10 o'clock this morning with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. Right off the bat, I'd like to tell you, for the next hour, you can reach us directly by phone at 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI, and I absolutely urge you to use that number and call us at any point in the show. Don't be shy, I'm telling you, we'll love to get calls here. Talking Animals, you can also instant message us via AOL Instant Messenger, screen name is Talking Animals. Other less immediate ways to be in touch include emailing us at talkinganimals@AOL.com and checking out our website, talkinganimals.net. Again, that's .net, folks. That's right. Also, before we move on, I want to thank Serena Sharp for another thought-provoking edition of the Serena Sharp Show. Meanwhile, here at Talking Animals, primarily we strive to learn about animals and animal issues from our guests, from news items, from your calls, from assorted other sources. But we're also here each week to celebrate animals through music, comedy, and all kinds of other means as well. We aim for a pretty spirited balance of those elements, as you can readily glean, by visiting our nifty website, talkinganimals.net. Talkinganimals.net. where nearly every show we've ever broadcast is archived, and we're a little behind, but gotten a little snag cleared up recently here at the station, so I think we're going to get caught up shortly on TalkingAnimals.net. So, clearly the heart of the program, really, is the interview we conduct each week with some notable inhabitant of some province of the animal world. Today, our guest is Michael Hingson, who was a sales executive working on the 78th floor of the World Trade Center, blind from birth, by the way, when the World Trade Center was attacked on 9/11, and then was led to safety by his guide dog, Roselle. Not surprisingly, perhaps, his life changed in all kinds of ways that day, including a career switch, and now has him working as an official with Guide Dogs for the Blind. We'll learn all about these things and others from Michael Hingson, who, by the way, is also a former KUCI staffer and program director, no less. Joins us in a few minutes. Meanwhile, it's time for our weekly look at items of interest and animal news. And I want to remind you of the phone number to join us on the show with your own comments and questions about animals, not only this week's animal news items, but also any other animal topic you'd care to discuss. Announcements, maybe there's a fundraiser or event that you're involved with animal-oriented coming up. Any observations in the animal world. Of course, any news stories you might have spotted that you think we should be talking about on the show. All of that would be most welcome. The number here again, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. So turning now to interesting or important developments recently in animal news. Typically, these are local, regional, national, occasionally international animal stories of note that seem important to spotlight. And with any luck to get your comments on and discuss, we also try to include a few announcements of upcoming events or activities that you may want to pencil in on your calendar. So, having said that, okay, I know, wait for it, yep. Let's talk turkey, as it were. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Let's go. Let's dive in, shall we? It's a local story, but again, as many that we select that are local, hopefully broader implications. Starts off, I took this from the LA Times, I think, a couple, 3 days ago. Don't know the exact date. Clip that part out. Huh? That's part of the Rip and Read service. After drugs fell short in helping their patient cope with emotional and mental problems, the three doctors prescribed another therapy for the woman. They suggested she get a dog. So the 52-year-old woman brought Lady, a poodle, into her Anaheim apartment building, which had a ban on dogs. When the landlord complained about Lady, the woman reluctantly took her to a kennel, and then the woman carved the dog's name into her arm and attempted suicide. While at the kennel, the ailing lady died. This week, the woman and her husband reached a tentative $185,000 settlement with their landlord after the couple's lawyers argued that the Federal Fair Housing Act entitled her to a dog regardless of the apartment building's pet prohibition. Quote, the law has long allowed people with disabilities to have an animal, said John Ward, the attorney representing Howard Cole and his wife. The law requires landlords to make, quote, reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities. That includes making an exception to a no-pet rule. The landlord, Lobby Property Management of Cyprus, entered into mediation with the Coles because its insurance company chose to settle the matters, said Lobby attorney Steve Saltman. There is no admission of liability or wrongdoing in the settlement agreement, said Saltman. However, he said the insurance company's representatives believed if the matter went to trial, the woman would be a very sympathetic witness, quote. The settlement is awaiting the landlord's signature, Saltman said, and it goes on from there. But pretty interesting, and again, maybe speaks to the power of having animals in your life and the therapeutic power in this case. Next, this actually came from USA Today. I meant to get to this last week, but ran out of time. I'm going to try not to enter too much editorial comment, but I may not succeed. The headline is from their science page, the beloved, as we like to call it locally here, at Boise Way at least. Elephants in the pink, animals at center of dispute last year, thrive in U.S. zoos. Starts off, zoos in California and Florida that a year ago angered animal rights groups by importing 11 elephants from Africa report that the animals are thriving in their new homes. Quote, these animals came out of the wild in a very emaciated state, malnourished and dehydrated, says Jeff Andrews, animal care manager at the San Diego Zoo's Wild Animal Park in Escondido, California, which brought over 7 of the elephants. The Lowry Park Zoo in Tampa imported the other 4. Quote, once they realized we're here to comfort them, And we're going to offer them everything they needed. They learned to trust us. And once they got into a better physical state, the trust became stronger and stronger, he says. The zoos haven't convinced those who oppose keeping the giant animals in captivity. Debbie Leahy of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, says the captive environment may eventually lead to health problems. In August 2003, the two zoos imported the elephants from Swaziland after protracted legal battle with animal rights activists. The Swazi government said it had an elephant overpopulation problem and would have to kill the endangered animals if they were not transferred. Again, trying to keep the editorial comment out, even of my voice. Limited success, right? Okay. Animal rights groups were skeptical and thought the zoos had used large financial incentives to obtain the animals. They said there were two wildlife reserves in South Africa and one in Mozambique willing to take the elephants. The Save Wild Elephants Coalition took the zoos to court. The coalition is a union of a number of prominent animal rights groups, PETA, Defense of Animals, Animal Protection Institute, and Born Free USA. The activists argued that wild elephants housed in zoos die young and do not breed well in captivity. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which authorized the transfer, eventually prevailed and the animals crossed the sea. It goes on from there. But any thoughts? Any comments? 949-824-5824-949-UCI-KUCI. And for a little item, we crossed the pond, if I may say that, and even if I may not. A British judge granted clemency to Dino, a dog who had been sentenced to death for biting a woman's hand in a case that had gone as far as the European Court of Human Rights. Dino, a 7-year-old German shepherd, was condemned after he bit a woman who tried to intervene in his fight with her dog in January 2001. His owner said the incident was out of character and spent tens of thousands of dollars to save him. The judge decided, quote, that this dog isn't a danger to public safety, said lawyer Trevor Cooper. Dino has kept his nose clean since the 2001 incident. So, yay, Dino! And everybody in the Dino camp, right? That's this one from the LA Times several days ago, I think, under their science file. Headline, chimps use right tool for the job, study finds. 6 months of continuous videotaping deep in the forests of the Republic of Congo have provided the most detailed look yet at the use of tools by chimpanzees to extract termites from their nests. The videotapes show the chimps using three tools, short and long probes, depending on the size of the nest, to puncture the nest and expose termites, and a third stick to fish out the insects. The fishing probe is most often made of a type of wood generally found at some distance from the nest, cricket sands. You heard me. Of Washington University and Dave Morgan of Cambridge University report in the November issue of the American Naturalist, animals modify the end of the probes with their teeth to give it a feathery surface, much like a paintbrush's, thereby allowing it to capture more termites. To understand why the chimps brought the probes from what was often a considerable distance, Sands and Morgan tried using other types of branches and found that they were not nearly as effective. Adult females were the most common visitors to the nest, with an average stay of about 12 minutes. Males visited less frequently. Mothers were often observed teaching their infants how to fish and showing them the proper use of these tools. The National Geographic Society sponsored that research. All right, time now for sort of our mid-news quiz question. You may know how this works. It's a true-false question. First person who calls in with the correct answer has their choice of a ever-growing array of prizes. Let's just mention a few of them, shall we? Let's try to even mention them either in different order, not the same ones that we've mentioned in the past. But one we want to mention, because it's fairly new and fairly cool, as a prize for this quiz question, or later for Name That Animal Tune towards the end of the show. It's the new Triumph DVD. Come on. Now, that's a cool prize. Tough to part with, frankly. But that's one of them. We also have a Talking Animals t-shirt. You've been to our website, talkinganimals.net. You see the cool logo, courtesy of the amazing and endlessly talented John Taylor. That's basically the cool element of the t-shirt, along with our little website address. And we also, if you really do it upright, or maybe if you win both things, you have a Talking Animals sweatshirt. How about that? And we've got T-shirts from various other animal organizations, including a cool one from Paws. It's a black T-shirt. It's a really neat diagram of drawing of an elephant. These elephants don't belong in circuses. It's from Paws. Books, including Meatless Meals for Young People. CDs, ranging from Ian Anderson. This is his solo, most recent solo CD, which has some animal songs on it. Of course, he was a guest on the show several months ago. To the most recent CD, fundraising kind of CD, that for PETA, called Liberation, Songs of Benefit PETA, with contributions from Goldfinger, Anti-Flag, The Used, Desperacitos, Good Charlotte's, Propaganda, etc. And we've got safety collars and cat toys and zillions of other things. All right, so you could choose from any of those. If you're the first person to correctly call in, or call in correctly, whatever the syntax is there, with the answer to this question. Speaking of elephants, here's our question. True or false? Elephants love beer and other forms of alcohol. They are known to seek out fermenting fruits. True or false? 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. And we're going to try to squeeze in one or two more quick items and step into the comedy corner, and then we'll be speaking with our guest, Michael Hingson. So I've moved this back into heavy rotation on the animal news. This is about the animal rescue site, which we've talked about a number of times on the show, but it bears repeating and repeating and repeating because it's just so cool and so easy. This is a website. The address is theanimalrescuesite.com. And you can go there every day. And once you get there, there's a little section that says that you can click on Feed an Animal in Need. And through an arrangement with various sponsors and advertisers, the, well, let's see. It looks like we might have a call. Maybe someone has a guest on the quiz question. Hi, you're on the air live on KUCI.
Hi. I'd say true.
It is true. It is true. I mean, that's among the many reasons we love elephants. They love beer, right?
So they make them good drinking partners.
I suppose, yeah. So so who's this?
This is Julie.
Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi. Well, any particular prize of those that we mentioned that you have your heart set on?
I like the T-shirt talking animals.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, flattery will get you everywhere. Okay, so I'll tell you what, Julie, since I can't really put you on hold and get your stuff, if you could email us at talkinganimals@AOL.com, and we'll verify that it's you in case anybody's thinking, hey, I'll call in, and or I'll email and pretend I'm Julie.
Okay.
Well, we have our ways, and then we'll figure out how to get that T-shirt to you.
Okay, thanks.
Cool, thanks so much for calling. Congratulations.
Thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so congratulations to Julie. And just to finish up on the animal rescue site, again, just if you can go to that site, theanimalrescuesite.com, click on Feed an Animal in Need, and you can do it every day. In fact, we urge you to do it every day. And again, through, as I was just saying, the arrangement with the corporate sponsors and advertisers that are involved doing so frees up indeed monies to feed and otherwise help abandoned, neglected animals in various facilities. So what's not to like? It's easy. Helps animals. You're on the internet anyway. Do it. All right. Well, I think at this point we've got to move along. If we have time at the end of the show, we'll come back to some of the other news items we hope to get to. But if there are any news stories or announcements of events you'd like to bring to our attention, please feel free to email us those at talkinganimals@AOL.com. We'd also love to encourage you to email us with any comments about the show, suggestions of future guests, ideas about animal songs, comedy bits, and any other animal topic that's on your mind. That email again is talkinganimals@AOL.com. And I'm pleased to remind you, I know it seems excessive, but only because it is, about the Talking Animals website. We hope you'll check out that site at talkinganimals.net. Again, that's .net. And sign up for the email list so we can keep you posted on upcoming guests and other announcements. You'll also find archives and synopses of all the shows, assorted photographs and articles, all kinds of links, other audio pieces and more. So please stop by and take a look around the site. Again, it's talkinganimals.net. Time now to step into the comedy, Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which as always, of course, involves animal-oriented comedy. And for one reason or another, I just thought we'd go with a vintage piece. So this is something from the Smothers Brothers called Gnus. You'll understand the pronunciation momentarily. On today's Comedy Corner here at KUCI.
Tommy,
what?
I want to know, have you ever thought about going into any other business?
Yes.
I mean, the escape route.
Yes.
What do you want to do?
I want to be a game hunter.
Game hunter?
Yeah. I want to go to the wilds of Australia and over in the east and be a big game hunter, where I want to hunt the most vicious animals in the world.
Like what? What have you always wanted to hunt? I've always wanted to hunt, you know, if I was a hunter, maybe elephants or tigers.
Elephants and tigers?
Maybe even a lion.
They're vicious.
And maybe even a puma.
There's no crevasses over there.
What do you want to hunt?
I want to hunt vicious animals in Australia.
What kind of animals?
Gnus.
Gnu?
They're indigenous to Australia, the wilds of Australia. The vicious gnus, they attack people.
They do?
Snarling, vicious gnus.
What do they do?
They just eat up pumas. Gnus are tough.
They're very tough. How do they hurt you?
Well, if you come on a band of gnus, a group of gnus, you better well walk softly, stranger. If you come on a group of gnus in Australia, you've got to be very careful, because if you get belligerent with the gnu, they'll attack you and knock you to your knees. You better have a good knife with you.
They seem awful vicious.
They're vicious.
Uh-huh. Well, why do you want to hunt them then?
I don't know. Nobody ever sees gnus. Very few people ever see gnus.
I don't know what a gnu is, and I don't even think there is such a thing. I'm not going to prolong this foolishness. There's no gnu. It's a product of your imagination.
Oh. Good thing I didn't go over there.
All right, that was the Smothers Brothers with a classic piece called Gnus, taken from their album entitled Curb Your Tongue, Knave, or maybe Knave. Comedy Corner is, of course, one of the signature features of Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're indeed listening to Talking Animals on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. As many of you know, we also stream live on the internet at KUCI.org. And some of you, no doubt, are listening that very way. And, of course, some of you perhaps are either through our small website, talkinganimals.net. Before we proceed, I'm obliged to remind you that the opinions and views expressed on Talking Animals are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. All right, then. Earlier in the show, I mentioned that this week's guest is Michael Hinkson, who is now an official with Guide Dogs for the Blind, but was previously an executive working on the 78th floor, one of the towers of the World Trade Center, when it was attacked on 9/11 and was led to safety by his guide dog, Roselle. And quite a bit previous to that, Michael attended UCI, and was also very involved with KUCI, including serving as a program director. And some of these things will intersect on October 27th, when Michael will be the featured speaker for UC Irvine's 2004 Disability Awareness Week. He'll deliver his talk at the Crystal Cove Auditorium in the UCI Student Center from 7:30 to 9, with a reception previously at 6:30. The event is free and open to the public. So, having said all that, let's remind you of the phone number to join us if you'd like to speak with Michael or ask any questions. It's 949-824-5824. And let's welcome Michael Hinkson to Talking Animals. Are you there, Michael?
I'm here. Gee, the only thing that's changed is the phone exchange, 824, huh?
Yeah, I suppose. You mean from your heyday?
It's always been 5824.
Well, we love consistency here at KUCI, don't we?
That's right.
All right, cool. Well, I don't know if you've ever been asked to recount what happened to you on September 11th? Now, something tells me I may not be the first interviewer to inquire, but we'll get into that, of course, singular story momentarily. But I actually may be the first interviewer to be speaking with you since then, at least, from the campus of your alma mater and broadcasting from a radio station that you worked at.
Absolutely the first from UCI.
Cool. Well, see, I'll take whatever kind of little status I can get. So let's go back to that period, and even before, if we can, let's talk a little bit about your time at at UCI, maybe even your formative years. First of all, you, if I'm not mistaken, you were actually born in Chicago, but otherwise you were a Southern California guy for most of your childhood years, correct?
Correct. Grew up in Palmdale, California, and then went to UCI long before there was a student center and a Crystal Theater.
Right.
And attended UCI from 1968 through 1976.
And even just to back up a little bit before that, you got your first guide dog, Squire, I believe it was.
Correct.
When you were 14. Is that right? About 14?
14, right.
Yeah. And was there discussion, in your family of getting a guide dog before that, or was that sort of just about the right age, for you to start off with a dog?
Well, actually, at least by today's rules, it was 2 years under the minimum age, and I'm not sure exactly what the rationale was for letting someone of the age of 14 come to the campus unless there wasn't that rule back then, and I have never gone back to check.
I see. Yeah, I was going to ask that very question, if there was or is a minimum age.
There is a minimum age.
Mm-hmm.
The fortunate occurrence in my life, I think, was that I had parents who believed that blindness wasn't going to be the gating factor or shouldn't be the gating factor in my life, that blindness isn't really the handicap that I face. And I have since come to be able to articulate this, as a number of blind people have. Blindness isn't the handicap, it's really the attitudes that we may have about ourselves, and also, just if not more important, the attitudes that society has about blindness. That is, the limitations put on blind people are mainly put on them by society, not by the fact that we have a so-called disability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's attitudinal then, really, within that person relative to what society is going to say.
There are certainly some things that I'm not going to do. I won't apply for a job as a truck driver. There is, however, a licensed pilot in Great Britain who is blind, who is beginning a round-the-world trip. There's certainly been blind people in a number of what are viewed as not usual kinds of activities for blind people. Eric Weinmeier, who climbed Mount Everest 3 years ago. Of course, I was in the World Trade Center, and I'm always asked about that.
Sure.
And always asked how I got out, and never asked why I was there or how I got there in the first place, which is really the issue.
Well,
and
we're definitely going to get into that.
There are a lot of blind people who have gone on to have jobs and work in virtually most areas in society, but it still is the rarity rather than the norm to expect that a blind person is going to function and live a so-called normal life like everyone else lives. And the reality is that today that is so prevalent that 80% of all employable blind people are either unemployed or underemployed. So I'm not overly traumatized by a job rate of 6% unemployment when I hear that among blind people it's 80%.
Oh, my God. And what, I mean, is it, I do want to get into a bit more about your UCI and KCI years, but I mean, just to pick up on that thread a little bit, I mean, is it just for the very reason that you're saying that despite people that are blind or impaired in terms of some part of their vision, is it really that the other side of the equation, which is the potential employers just can't get past their own biases and that's why there's that staggering of a rate?
Sure, the impairment goes both ways.
Yeah.
Most people in society are blind impaired,
sure.
And the fact of the matter is that they don't understand that there's another way to function. They don't recognize the fact that there are true alternatives to being able to use your sight. And in our society, it's so prevalent. I was in St. Louis, Missouri a couple of weeks ago and heard in the course of 40 minutes on a ride from the outskirts of St. Louis into a meeting and a speech that I was to give at SBC, I heard three LASIK commercials, three commercials about eye surgery, and every one of them talked about saving your precious sight and talked in terms of you would truly not be able to live if you couldn't see.
That is so
predominant in our society. There was a Gallup poll done some 30 years ago that, second only to dying of cancer, expressed a fear of going blind. Not becoming disabled, but going blind. Yes, it's very prevalent in our society.
So what can be done about that? Because obviously, again, we'll circle around to this more specifically as well. But you're now working with the folks with Guide Dogs for the Blind. I mean, how can that be sort of eroded, at least, if not busted down? Or
it's a long process.
The
fact is that what people need to do is to see more role models, to see universities and colleges become centers for diversity, for organizations to promote the fact that blindness isn't really the handicap. It also means a need to teach our graduating doctors, our physicians, our ophthalmologists, that blindness isn't really the handicap and that blindness isn't the end of the world, and that rather than painting an absolute picture of doom and gloom if they encounter persons who are going blind, whether it be from retinitis pigmentosa, macular degeneration, or diabetes, or just old age, the fact is that what they could do is to help educate those people or get them to places where they can be educated. But that's not what our medical profession does primarily today.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it is just going to be kind of a long road, and people just got to keep at it, and people that do what you do and others just got to keep getting that message, you know, across as loud and clear until people are listening in larger numbers, I guess.
No matter what the Americans with Disabilities Act says and no matter what the provisions are, I can still walk into a restaurant on any given day and possibly face being told to leave because I have a guide dog or because I'm blind or that I'm different. And I have been challenged in public places for all three of those reasons.
Wow. Boy, that's discouraging to say the least. Man.
Well, it can be discouraging, but mm-hmm. I think the trick is not to become discouraged,
sure.
But rather to develop a tough enough skin to say, hey, but the law is on my side.
Right.
Not by filing a lawsuit, but rather by educating to
sure.
say, look, here's the other side of the story. And mostly that works. To take that another step, I have faced several situations, and very recent ones, where I have had to go off and go into an education mode about dealing with blindness, about dealing with the fact that I have a guide dog.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not had to work and go into a mode of legal action.
Yeah.
Suing is just the absolute last resort.
Sure.
And generally there's no need to do that. There are a lot of steps to be taken before then.
Well, and like so many things, I mean, the opportunity well before that, as you pointed out, is if you can take that same situation and use it to educate people, because many of those people that are probably, you know, confronted you, resisted, whatever, at least a large percentage, I'm guessing, was out of ignorance.
For me, after 9/11 occurred,
mm-hmm.
I had a choice of how to deal with what occurred that day. And the fact is that we were on the 78th floor in the North Tower on the south side of the building, so I and all the people on my side of the building, at least for a while, had no idea what happened.
Mm-hmm.
A number of us didn't have an idea for a while. In fact, I didn't know what occurred until both buildings had come down. But after 9/11, I had a choice of how to deal with that, as all of us did.
Sure.
And it was difficult to talk about it. I happened to gain a lot of media attention. And because of that attention, I was confronted with the choice of, do I talk to the press or do I not? And my wife and I discussed it, and we decided that even though it would turn our lives upside down, which it did for many months, that it would be appropriate to talk about 9/11 for three reasons. One, to help people move on from it,
mm-hmm.
and to learn that normal isn't the same. I heard from my colleagues out in California so often after 9/11, oh, you've got to get back to normal. And it was so difficult to make them understand, you don't even know what normal is anymore.
Yeah,
normal
right.
is different.
Yeah, it's gone.
But if it
yeah.
would help people get back to normal, or would help people move on to a new normal,
yeah.
then it was good. If it would help people learn a little bit more about blindness and maybe think about the fact that blind people can function and live in the world, and yes, we can be survivors of 9/11 and perhaps not,
sure.
and other similar things, then it would be helpful. And the third was, of course, to help raise money for Guide Dogs for the Blind, because Roselle certainly was an incremental fact in both of our escapes from the tower, and if it would help raise money for Guide Dogs, it was a good thing. Well, the thing that happened by making that choice was that it became easier to talk about it because it made me think about it and realize that the assumptions that I had started with was, which was that talking about it could be helpful, also helped me.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's the same thing insofar as dealing with blindness, with dealing with discrimination. If you don't go off and deal with it, if you just go off and become angry and become paralyzed from it,
mm-hmm.
then the other side has already won.
Sure.
And discrimination is the same way
mm-hmm.
as what we dealt with on 9/11. It's an attitudinal issue, in this case, my attitude.
Yeah.
And so I learned to deal with what happened on 9/11 as I've learned through the years to deal with blindness and recognize that blindness isn't really the handicap. The handicap is what we make it.
Sure. Well, Michael, looks like we might have a call. Would you like to take a call from
Sure.
Someone? Okay. Hi, you're on the air live on KCI with Michael Hankson, the Talking Owl.
I have a question for Michael.
Please. Go ahead.
Hello, Michael. I remember reading the story about your marvelous escape from that World Trade Center. I'm so happy you're with us. I just wanted to ask you about voting. What happens for blind people when they go to vote? Are facilities set up in every precinct or every election area? Could you tell me that? I have no idea about that.
They are not today. Are you blind or disabled?
Am I? No.
Okay. Just curious. They are not today. The Help America Vote Act, however, has mandated that there will be electronic voting machines available for blind persons in every precinct by the year 2006. The problem for us is that in the past, we have not been able to vote ourselves. And the fact is that that has resulted in blind people going to precincts needing help to vote and people not recording the votes that they've been asked to record. It has been that blatant.
Mm.
The only other way to vote is absentee. But the bottom line is we have not had truly the same opportunity to exercise our right to vote. And now with the funding available from the Help America Vote Act and the mandates of that legislation, it is a law that each precinct shall have at least one machine that is accessible, and the machines are accessible today. Now, there are some other challenges with it because there's some discussion about electronic voting machines needing to have a paper trail, and a paper trail being that if you make a vote, that it must also be recorded on paper and that you have to verify
right.
what that paper says. And there are ways to do that so a blind person can do it. So the hope is that whatever decision is made as to how the voting machines are implemented, they will deal with the accessibility issue, because if they don't by 2006 in every precinct, there's going to be a rash of lawsuits.
I see. So what you're saying is for the upcoming U.S. election, that it's possible that these problems will still exist then?
It's hit and miss. Some precincts and some counties in California and other parts of the country have instituted voting accessibility, but a number have not. It's unfortunate that people haven't moved more quickly to put voting accessibility into the various precincts, and I hope that it will happen, but it is still very much hit and miss.
I see. Well, thank you for taking my call, Michael. I hope it makes people more aware of the situation. Thank you.
I hope so, and I hope people will deal with it and write their congressmen and insist that the law be enforced and that all people, including blind people, have access and the right to vote and make that right actually happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. What a great question. I mean, that just that alone is outrageous. That as you're saying, at least for this upcoming election, it could be hit or miss, as you say.
It will be hit and miss.
Yeah.
In fact, most people will not have access to it, and some places are fighting it very seriously.
Oh, geez. Well, I want to remind our listeners, this is Talking Animals on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. We're speaking with Michael Hankson, an alum of both UCI and KUCI, and now employed by Guide Dogs for the Blind, with quite an interesting career and life path in between those points. We'd love to have you join the conversation, as our caller just did, by calling us at 949-824-5824. 949-UCI-KUCI, or if you're the shy type and rather IMS, you can do so by way of AOL Instant Messenger. The screen name is Talking Animals. All right, Michael, well, then how about this? Can you give us kind of a telescoped travelogue of your sort of professional journey from UCI grad to joining Quantum ATL, which I think is sort of pivotal leading into the actual 9/11 story.
My first job out of college was working for an organization of blind people called the National Federation of the Blind, specifically to test and evaluate what at that time was a new technology. It was the first machine that would read print out loud to blind people, and it was revolutionary because it was the first machine that would read any type or proportionally spaced printed material. Ray Kurzweil, the developer of it, had looked for an application as opposed to just flooding the market with this technology. He wanted to do something useful with it, and his choice was to develop this machine that would read out loud. Unlimited vocabulary speech, although much more in its infancy than today, existed, and so he was able to marry the technologies and develop this machine, and he had been very much instrumental in developing the Omnifont OCR system. So I worked for an organization of blind people that took these machines completely out of the manufacturer setting, took five prototypes that were purchased under some foundation grants, and established sites around the country to test the machines, to provide feedback and input to the manufacturer for the development of the first real consumer version of the machine. So it's a very unusual process that prototypes were allowed completely out of the hands of the manufacturer of any kind of equipment. And so I did that for 18 months, literally living out of suitcases and in hotels, and had my own toolbox to make sure that the machines kept repaired. Hey, all that physics training at UCI came up with something.
Well, there you go.
And after that, I went to work for the manufacturer, and through a set of circumstances, eventually ended up in sales for them, not selling the product for the blind, but selling the commercial version, which was sold to anything from publishers to law offices to anyone who needed to take old documents and scan them and get them into a computer-readable form. Something that's very commonplace today was extremely unusual 25 years ago.
Sure.
And so I did that until Xerox purchased the company, and Xerox brought in its own sales force and told the pre-Xerox takeover sales folks to leave the company, which we had no choice about doing.
Sure.
I began my own business in San Juan Capistrano. I had moved to the East Coast to work for Kurzweil. Kurzweil sent me back to the West Coast to be part of the Xerox interfacing and to open an office here for the company. Then Xerox, of course, later did what they did. So I had to start my own business because I was not able to find a job. I went on a number of job interviews. I sent out hundreds of resumes like everyone else. And an interesting thing, if I mentioned on the resume that I was blind, I never got selected to even come in for an interview. If I didn't mention it, at least I got an interview. And that's a dilemma that we all face.
Wow.
Who happened to be blind.
Yeah.
And I had interviews canceled at the last minute because people discovered that I was blind through a variety of circumstances. Mm. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
So I started my own business selling computer-aided design systems to architects.
Wow.
And that's a story that is a long one in and of itself, but the bottom line, there are ways to do that.
Wow. Hey, Michael, can you hold on one second? Looks like we might have another caller, and I'd like to see if they might want to have a question for you.
Sure.
Okay, cool. Hi, you're on the air live on KUCI with Michael Hinkson. It's Talking Animals.
Hi, Michael. Can you describe how your dog saved you? How was that possible?
Well, we're getting to that. Hold the phone. Of course, we're getting to that story. He's in the midst of leading into that story.
Oh,
but,
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
No, that's
a good question.
No, but,
I like the way you phrased it, and I will get to that.
Yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
Great.
Thanks
for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very cool. Yeah, but so basically the sort of career path is leading us right into the job that sort of led you to...
There we go.
That led you to the North Tower. So I guess we may as well, get to that point
So we'll get there really quickly.
Yeah,
then.
Sure.
Bottom line, I had that business for 4 years and eventually decided to go back into the regular workforce and applied for a particular sales position with a company and was confronted with the usual dilemma. How do I deal with blindness or not to get to an interview stage? And so...
Sure.
When I worked for Kurzweil, I took a number of courses, sales courses, including the Dale Carnegie sales course. And one of the things in the Dale Carnegie sales course, one of the most valuable lessons that anyone in sales can ever learn is that what you need to do is to figure out a way to take liabilities and turn them into assets. And my wife reminded me of that one day as I was struggling with writing some intro letters for doing a job search. And a light went off, and so I wrote a letter to a particular company down in Carlsbad, California, which eventually hired me. And one of the things that I said in the letter, essentially, was that I wanted to tell them that there is something about me that is important for them to know, and that is that I am blind, and that's the most important reason for them to hire me. Because as a blind person, I have spent all of my life selling just to be able to survive, whether it be renting a house or whether it be taking a guide dog into a restaurant or getting a college education.
Sure.
So when they're considering who they want to hire, do they want to hire someone who's just had a few years of professional sales experience, or do they want to hire someone who knows how to sell because it's been a lifelong process? And that got me the job.
Wow.
So
well done.
That company, which was called Articon, which has since evolved into a company called Dothill, and is still selling disk storage systems in the world today and doing a good job, as near as I can tell. Anyway, Dothill and that point, Articon, in 1996 sent me back to New York to open an office, and we did in the World Trade Center, in fact, on the 23rd floor of the South Tower.
Okay.
And I worked for them for a while and then was recruited to join another company, and eventually in 1999 joined Quantum Corporation as the manager of the New York region to coordinate efforts to sell the tape backup products that Quantum was manufacturing, and working with the distribution sources and channels back there, as well as reseller partners, as well as hiring our own sales force. And in August of 2000, we opened our office on the 78th floor of Tower 1, the North Tower of the World Trade Center.
Oh, okay. I must have misread something, because when I was preparing to do this interview, I thought it was August 01.
No, it was August of 2000,
okay,
August 1st, 2000.
Okay. All right. So go ahead. Sorry. So it wasn't a month before. It was a year and a month before then. Yeah. Okay.
So we opened that office on August 1st, 2000. But I was basically through the World Trade Center every day.
Sure.
I've heard numbers of all sorts, but I've heard as many as a million people may have gone through the center every day going to and from work. It was a major nexus for transportation systems, the New York subway system, the PATH system, which was a train that ran from New York to New Jersey. PATH stands for Port Authority Trans-Hudson. It was trains that went into the Hudson River specifically to move people back and forth. And of course, buses and so many ways that people got in. So on August 1st, we opened that office, and I was there for 13 months plus a little bit. When we were in our office on September 11th, 2001, mm-hmm. I'd come in to train some reseller partners that day. We had 50 folks coming in four sessions, had the PowerPoint projectors all set up. And, of course, there's the great question, how does a blind guy do PowerPoint? Dead easy, but another story. And so we were there at 8:45 when the plane actually hit the building.
Mm.
And contrary to what people read in newspapers and sort of probably imagined, again, think about what was occurring. The plane hit the building. The building had some spring to it because it was made to sway in windstorms. Okay. The building actually started to tip over. It didn't sway back and forth like an earthquake. It moved in one direction.
Mm.
And we estimate it moved maybe as much as 20 feet.
And
I had a colleague in the office with me from our California office, David Frank. And David and I were in my office, and we had some guests in the office preparing to be trained. So David and I were in the office when the building hit. We were in my specific office, and the others were in the conference room. And we said goodbye to each other. We thought that the building was going to fall over. It moved enough that we were pretty certain we were going to fall 78 floors to the street.
Even though at that point you didn't know necessarily what was causing that, you just knew that it was so dramatic that you guys were going down.
It was absolutely that dramatic.
Yeah.
There was no question that something dramatic had happened.
Yeah.
Roselle, my guide dog, was asleep under my desk, which she usually is. She greets everyone, then she goes back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I need to stop and explain a little bit, I think, about guide dogs. Guide dogs for the blind, where Roselle comes from, has trained all five of the guide dogs that I have. And all of the services of guide dogs are provided at no charge. The school provides lifetime scholarships for anyone who comes to the campus to get a dog, including paying their ways, including room and board and the dog and so on. It's a pretty expensive proposition. And the services are available as long as people can use guide dogs. We're certainly well aware that that's an expensive proposition, and we're actually gathering numbers as to to what I'm about to talk about, but we estimate that it will cost between $300,000 and $400,000 per student over the life of that student's interactions with guide dogs to be able to continuously come back and get guide dogs.
Wow.
It's a very expensive thing. We're trying to nail down the numbers for sure, but it's not a cheap process to come every so often, get a guide dog, and then go home and deal with follow-up services and so on. But all of that's provided at no charge. The school gets no funding from the government at all. It's strictly from private contributions. So anyone who's interested can certainly go to www.guidedogs.com to learn about giving, or they can call me here at the school, which is 800-295-4050, extension 4177, and I'll be glad to steer them the right way. I mention all that because the most important thing we learn at Guide Dogs is to build a team, a team in this case of a dog and a person.
Yeah.
And going back to our caller's questions about the dog saving me and getting me out of the building, it's important to know that's a two-body process. It isn't all the dog and it isn't all me.
Sure.
Roselle's job as a guide dog is to make sure that we walk safely, to make sure that we go from place to place without falling downstairs, walking out in front of a moving car. But when we come to street corners, for example, it's not her job to know when to cross the street. It's a matter of her making sure that we walk safely.
Mm-hmm.
I tell us when to cross the street by the way the traffic is flowing.
Sure.
And traffic flow is the ultimate way to know. And then Roselle is sort of the fine tuner of that and the pilot who can say, oh, but I see a car coming. I'm going to pull you out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
But my job is to know where to go and how to get there and when I want to go there.
Sure.
So I'm the navigator of the team.
Okay.
So, for example, in the World Trade Center, I learned the buildings. I learned where all of the various stores were. On the first floor between all of the towers is a shopping mall, or was a shopping mall, and I knew what was there and where it was, and I knew where all the offices were inside the tower. I knew what the different floors looked like because I traveled them all to learn them.
Sure.
And knew where most of our customers were and how to get there. I knew where the stairwells were because I took courses, well, not courses so much as attended all the evacuation procedures, classes, and fire drills and so on. So I learned how to get from place to place and how to know how to find out where I was so that if there ever were an emergency, I could direct Roselle.
Right.
And then trust Roselle to do her job. So trust is a big part of it as well.
Sure. So we just probably, Michael, sorry, we only have maybe about a minute or two left. So it sounds like really it was that your training and Roselle's training that combined, in a very specific way that day.
It was absolutely the case that it was both of us, and then after we got outside, I think the more dramatic part was we were about 100 yards away from Tower 2 when it fell and had to run. And again, Roselle continued to guide, and I continued to encourage her, but it was a team effort that got us both out and kept us both alive. And that team effort is something that anyone can apply in their jobs and in their home life, and trust and teamwork is a lot of what we'll talk about when I come down and visit next week.
Yeah, no, that's great. And again, I want to remind people that you will be here on campus on the 27th, speaking from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at Crystal Cove Auditorium right here on the UCI Student Center. And as you say, we'll be talking about, I guess, among other things, disability, teamwork, survival, and that is free and open to the public, so we urge anyone interested to come meet Michael in person. So literally in our probably remaining 60 seconds, Michael, I mean, anything specific that you just want to tell us in terms of the aftermath? Obviously, among the many changes to your life, which you've touched on earlier in the interview, but you switched careers, and you're, of course, now working with Guide Dogs for the blind.
Switched careers. I now work for Guide Dogs in fundraising and development, but I also travel the world talking about the subjects that we've spoken about here.
Mm-hmm.
And like any speaker, I charge fees for what I do, and all
sure.
those fees go straight back to Guide Dogs, which is sort of my commitment and way of giving back to the organization.
Yeah.
But the fact is that we can't live our lives in fear. We can't be paralyzed, even what happened by 9/11. And I say that from having been there and being a survivor of it. And if we live our lives in fear and allow ourselves to be overcome by that, then the bad guys have already won, and that's not acceptable.
Sure, Sure. Well, I mean, what better model of that exact principle in action are you and Roselle? So, well, Michael, I wish we had more time to chat, but again, we urge people to come out and listen to you speak on the 27th, and I'll give again more details at the end of the show about that. But thank you very, very much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and we'll see you next week.
Well, thanks, and hope to get by the station and take a look and see how things have changed.
Yeah, well, again, probably not much more different than the phone number, right?
So, probably not.
All right.
I won't be able to be there for the 35th reunion, which is coming up next month, but
yeah.
At least we'll try to come by.
That's great. Thanks again, Michael.
Thank
all
you.
Right. All the best. Bye-bye now. All right. I want to thank again Michael Hingston for joining us on Talking Animals. The website is guidedogs.com, and I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals on KUCI in Irvine, 88.9 FM, streaming live on the Internet. KUCI.org. It's time for Name That Animal Tune. You know how it works. It's like any other version of Name That Tune, except it's animal-oriented. See if you can name this animal tune. First person who does calls in 949-824-5824-949-UCI-KUCI. We'll get a choice of those prizes that we mentioned earlier. Your sign is Capricorn in every corner of your reach back into the vaults for this one, but, you know, we mix it up. You never know what's going to strike a chord with people. So, okay, we at least wanted to get to that point. 949-824-5824, but if it does ring a bell. Anyway, I'm Duncan Strauss. We have just about reached the end of this week's edition of Talking Animals. I want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KUCI, UCI, or the University of California Board of Regents. I want to again thank our guest, Michael Hingston. Website is guidedogs.com. And one more time, next it's Wednesday, October 27th, he'll be speaking on campus as part of UC Irvine's 2004 Disability Awareness Week. It's going to be held in Crystal Cove Auditorium at the UCI Student Center. His talk will be from 7:30 to 9, preceded by reception at 6:30 in the Crystal Cove lobby. Michael will address again the aspects of disability, teamwork, and survival. His talk is open to the public and admission is free. And also, I want to thank you all for listening. For the phone calls we receive next Monday, at least tentatively, our guest will be Allison Giannotto, an expert on animal abuse and cruelty, who created PetAbuse.com, a database for animal abuse cases across the country, which seeks to, among other things, break the cycle of abuse through action, education, and information. So hope you'll join us for that on Talking Animals next Monday, October 25th. And we're going to have to skip all our other usual blather, except to mention that later on today on another public affairs talk show, it's Matt Kaplan, first with the Counterspin, and then at 5:30 with Planetary Radio, because Matt also was who brought Michael to my attention, for which I owe him great thanks. And I want to urge you, again, to check out our website, talkinganimals.net, and please sign up for the email list there. Please stay tuned for Jeff Scott and the Blues Disease coming up momentarily here on KUCI. This has been, indeed, Talking Animals on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And as always, we're going to start, going to close things out here with an animal-related tune. One of my favorite animal songs at the moment. This is brand new music from Jarrett Watkins with a song called Turn That Chicken Down. KUCI, we'll catch you next week. I'm Talking Animals.